Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice radio show. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal economic opportunity and justice for all without truth decay. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing both creative artists and political unity as solutions to our challenges. Welcome to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice. And today's Reasonable Voice is director and screenwriter Kevin Duncan Wong. Kevin Duncan Wong is the director of Home is a Hotel and one of the film's producers. After a stint in visual effects powerhouse, ILM, Kevin Duncan Wong ventured into the world of independent filmmaking. In 2005, while at San Francisco State University, Kevin Wong produced, shot, and edited a SFSU-funded documentary entitled A Moral Debt, about the unjust treatment of World War II Filipino veterans. Director Wong's nonfiction films have played at festivals across the country, including Big Sky, SF Film, and Cinequest, and have been featured on PBS and in The Washington Post. Kevin's narrative films include Forgetting, an adaptation of an episode of WNYC's Radiolab, and Jus Soli, a sci-fi thriller about immigration and data privacy starring Len Chen. He is a 2022 Sundance Humanities Sustainability Fellow and SF Film Film House resident for Home is a Hotel, and was a BAVC Media Maker Fellow in 2016. His feature screenplay, Nelly, was a second-round selection in the 2013 Sundance Screenwriters Lab. Let's also mention other artists on Kevin's production team, editor Christina Matwani, and co-directors Todd Sills and Car Yin Pham. So welcome, Kevin Duncan Wong, to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. How are you this fine day?
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, my pleasure to have you. Let's start with a few things from your past. A Moral Debt. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so that was a project at SF State, which is where I went to school. They have a program, basically during your senior year, you spend the first semester studying the form of documentary, like long form documentary, and sort of like looking at all the different shapes and sizes that can take, from, you know, pure Frederick Wiseman verite to your historical, Ken Burns style thing, and kind of everything in between. And then at the end of that first semester, you pitch a project for a 30-minute, like, broadcast-style documentary, and then they pick two of those, and the school has, like, dedicated resources to produce those, and then everyone in the class serves as the crew. And so my friend Martine Rossetti had, his wife is Filipino, and her grandfather had been a Filipino who fought on the side of the U.S. during World War II, and he knew sort of the story, which is basically that the U.S. made certain promises to foreign nationals who fought on the side of the U.S., and then basically reneged on those promises only for Filipinos. They didn't renege on those promises for Italians or Germans or French people. And so it was a documentary basically about sort of like their struggle to be recognized for their contribution to the U.S.'s efforts during the war and basically like get access to the same benefits that those other nationals who fought on the side of the U.S. did.
You know, that seems to be a sad consistency with American history. I'm so glad I asked the question because I'm, like I'm sure most Americans, unaware that that happened, and I appreciate your answer. I really do. Big Sky, SF Film, CineQuest, well, what were your experiences there, and how did they, you know, contribute to where you are now?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's funny because I have, you know, I made a number of films over the course of my career, but the one that sort of seems to have really taken off was this short that inspired this feature project, Cohelma Soko. And that short film getting into those festivals was really kind of the spark that sort of told myself and Todd, who was the other director on that short with me, kind of really told us, like, hey, there's, you know, interest here in a way that hadn't really been shown for previous stuff that we'd made. And it was just going to those festivals with the short film and seeing the audience response was really kind of what motivated us to try to do the crazy undertaking that is trying to make a feature document, an independent feature documentary with this film. So that was kind of what happened there. But yeah, I mean, it's always fun to have the opportunity to screen your work for people, and my favorite part really is like, you know, being in the audience in the dark room with the audience full of people, and then sort of like feeling their energy as they watch the film.
I know. Don't you love that?
Yeah, yeah, it's pretty great.
Yeah, you know, I always assume, because I have a lot of independent filmmakers on the show, but maybe we should explain what independent means.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of, it can be sort of like a little bit of a misunderstanding. And there's like such a wide range in that too. Like, strictly speaking, independent just means that the project was produced outside of the traditional studio system. But even within that, you know, you have companies like A24 that are technically independent, but huge, huge, huge operations, right? And they're producing documentaries and fiction projects all the time that are technically independent. And then you have the other end of the spectrum, which is where I am, which is basically like, you know, we literally, that short film that inspired this feature, we shot that over, I think, like 3 weekends. Nobody got paid. We basically just bought everybody lunch and sort of like worked on it on our free time in between other freelance work that we were doing. And then with this feature, we kind of were like, let's, you know, we think this is a good idea. Let's just start making it. We had no money and no connections and no support really from anywhere at the outset. And I will say, like, part of that journey was also the support we got from Bayback, which you mentioned, in 2016, which was the first year that we had started the film. That was a fellowship. Bayback is a sort of Bay Area Video Coalition. They're an organization that supports nonfiction filmmakers here in the San Francisco Bay Area. And, you know, had I not been part of that fellowship, I think we probably wouldn't have continued with the project, because they were, you know, that wasn't like financial support, but it was sort of like professional and moral support in terms of like, this is how you make a project as an independent person without, you know, any kind of like large corporation or institution behind you. This is how you kind of like gather the support that you need to make a project. But yeah, independent really means like, on my end of the spectrum, independent really means like fully independent. Like, I do the taxes for the company that we set up for the film. I do the accounting. I book all the travel lights, you know, we really like kind of do everything ourselves. So that's what independent means.
Okay. That's one of the better definitions I've ever heard of it. You're really quite comprehensive. And yes, it doesn't mean you're all alone, but it does mean sometimes you feel like it, especially financially. But excellent, excellent answer. Well, I'm curious about Len Chen and the work you did with her. Tell us something about that.
Yeah, so that was so that project usually is Latin for right of the soil, which is sort of the legal term for birthright citizenship. And so that film, I don't know if folks in your audience are familiar, but Lynn is a sort of like a longtime indie and working actor. She's you know, been on shows like Fear of the Walking Dead, and she was in this really amazing film that was at Sundance many years ago called The Saving Face, and she's known as like a really great comedic talent, but we were able to get her for my short film, which was a dramatic one. And that film is really about you know, in like 2016, obviously everybody remembers that year, but we were hearing a lot about what was going on with immigration and sort of like people whether or not they were born in the U.S. questioned by folks, and then also people in like the Republican primary like questioning the idea of like whether or not we should have birthright citizenship in this country. And at the same time, we also found out that my grandfather had passed away, and we found out that he had been what was called a paper son, which is basically he claimed when he came to the U.S., he claimed to be like someone other than he was, which was made possible because in San Francisco in 1906, the fire destroyed most of the birth records, and so a lot of people said, a lot of immigrants from China who were not allowed to immigrate unless they were family at that time because of the Chinese Exclusion Act, people would say, I had three sons, and then they would sort of like that a cousin or a family friend or somebody sort of like pretend to be their son and come over on that. And so we found out that that was how actually he came to the United States. And then also at the same time, we were hearing about like DNA heritage companies like handing over their information to law enforcement. And it was sort of this like imagination of like, what if the U.S. kind of continues on this trajectory that it's going with this rhetoric around immigration and people not having sort of control of the privacy of their data about their DNA, and sort of like that all what if that all comes together in this sort of like dystopian future where they're actually going backwards in time and like using the DNA evidence to like find people whose grandparents and great grandparents like came under like, you know, what some people now would call like quote illegal immigrants, right? Like going back and sort of like finding those people who are like unjustly in the United States, in quotes. And so it's basically a interrogation scene from that future. And so Lynn plays a woman who comes in thinking she's going in for a relatively routine interview about her family history to prove her citizenship, and then they kind of like hit her with the bombshell that they have some information on her that she didn't know.
Wow. And in real life, I suppose there are some politicians who would indeed do that. You know?
Yeah, well, that,
nothing better to do with their time. Gee.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, I think. So the other piece of it is that all of the, intentionally when I was writing that script, all of the laws and things that are sort of like in place in that future all either like have been laws in the past or are currently laws. So, for example, one of the laws in the film is like that there's a law that's passed that like only citizens can own property, right? And like Texas just passed a law banning Chinese nationals from owning property in the U.S., right? Like we're seeing it play out, unfortunately, in this country. And it was unfortunate that when we made the film, it was unfortunate the pandemic happened, and so we weren't really able to play a lot of festivals, but we specifically made the decision to release that film online in the lead up to the 2020 election, because we felt like the message that it had was more important than it having saving it for a festival run down the line.
Understood. You know, I do believe, I'm not a historian by any means, but I do love history, and I think another thing that would feed into your thinking about this film and other films that you're making is that at some point in American history, the Chinese in particular were banned or charged more to work the mines in California. And the reason that happened is because the Germans and the Irish immigrants didn't want the competition because the Chinese worked harder and longer hours, according to... But I don't know, don't anybody call me, but I think... I do know about the banning of the Chinese from being allowed to work, and if anyone knows anything about coal history, and initially in America, people paid as much to be involved as they... more, in many cases, than they were being paid. There's a lot to that, and if you want to correct me, look up the history. I'd be glad to hear what you find out, and I think you will find out things as we do, and it seems in all of Duncan Wong's films, and the ones he's talked about, and the ones I've seen, and the ones we're going to talk about in the next segment. There is clearly a mission here to get the truth, you know, known. And I'm going to introduce the second segment now because I want you to think about it, everybody, while we take a break in a moment. What the subject is in My Home is a Hotel is SROs, and I'm going to expose my ignorance on it. I had no idea what an SRO was, and I had to find out before, you know, interviewing Kevin today. And when you see his film, and of course when we talk about it in the second segment, you're going to find out, I'm sure many of us will find out things that we never knew existed right here in what we call the land of the free and justice for all, and you know, the home of the brave. I'm not putting down America, but I think America needs the attention of all Americans so that we understand that it's not a privileged situation for everybody. How's that? Someone called me privileged the other day and I was shocked, but after watching SRO, I know what he means. So, we're going to take a short break. Our guest today is the filmmaker, Kevin Duncan Wong. He has done a lot of stuff we've just been talking about. He's been talking about most informative and giving us great details about his journey thus far. And his latest is Home is a Hotel. And we're going to take a break. We're going to come back and we're going to talk in great detail about Home is a Hotel. But think about that phrase and find out what SRO means in the break. Take care. We'll be right back. Stay with us, though. To better understand and grasp the gravity of SROs, as illustrated in the independent film directed by our guest today, Kevin Duncan Wong, here is a scene, a trailer, from his independent film, Home is a Hotel.
A SRO is a room. And you gotta build your whole life in a room.
No kitchen, bathroom in the hallway. It's called a single room occupancy, SRO hotel.
Could you fit your whole life in a room?
I said, I need a place to be, to get clean, you know, to stay clean. I can't do it homeless.
No one wants to live this way where your table doubles as your bed. But I'll take my blessings wherever I can get them because I definitely didn't have anywhere else to go.
An intimate portrait of five households living in 80-square-foot single-room occupancies.
My parents and I were lucky to even get this room. It's $900, but it's a place we could call home.
Winner of the Jury Award for Bay Area Documentary and the Audience Award at the San Francisco International Film Festival, Home is a Hotel takes a deep dive into surviving on the margins in one of the country's most expensive cities. Visit www.homeisahotel.com for screening info.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voices News Talk Radio program. I'm your host, Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. And today's Reasonable Voice is director and screenwriter Kevin Duncan Wong. We've talked about his journey in the past through a mortal debt, Big Sky, SF Film, Cinequest. He's working with Len Chen. And we're going to move on now to the primary reason I asked him to come on, but he had so much to say of value that we dedicated this segment to it, and I'm not sorry for that, for what we learned from him. But now we want to talk about home is a hotel. I hope you've been thinking about that in the break, because some of us are here to learn about this, because I had to learn about it, and I'll tell you, it's a difficult story to imagine, but it's true, and here we go. First of all, Home is a Hotel opens with this quote. In the early 1980s, San Francisco began a policy of using residential hotels. Now that sounds great, right? Residential hotels as a stopgap solution to address the city's growing decline in affordable housing. Well, when I first read that, I thought, oh, what a great idea. I mean, a residential hotel. I've stayed in hotels. Well, we're going to let Kevin tell you about these hotels and about the people who live in them. Did the discovery, by the way, of the 1980s California history influence your making of Home is a Hotel? And if so, how?
Yeah, so I will say that the historical aspect of the film, or the historical context of the film, definitely came later. And it came, we had been, when I was, when the project was selected for the Sundance Humanities Fellowship, one of the things, in addition to the grant that they gave us, was they also facilitated a humanities advisor. This really great woman, her name's Kelly Knight, she works at the UCSF Center, I always forget the title, but the UCSF Benioff Center for Vulnerable Populations, I think is the title of it, but basically is a kind of like a public health arm of the UCSF hospital that studies issues of housing insecurity and sort of like the health, public health impacts and health impacts of that. And so, but I mean, really the interest in the subject, in the story, was, you know, the contemporary today's situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really sort of like digging deeper into sort of what was going on and sort of like asking ourselves how did we get here, that we kind of like dug up some of the research and felt like including that title card at the beginning of the film was important.
You know, something else, if I may ask a director's question, that, you know, that's my thing too. It's not a traditional documentary in the sense that, or what we're used to, let's put that. It's not what we're used to. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I guess it sort of depends on
what you're used to. Well, I mean, there isn't a series of what do I want to say? It doesn't have people sitting in a room detached from the subject who are expected to be supposedly experts on the subject telling us about what we're going to see. Instead, you do something, and this wasn't the first question I wanted to ask, but just listening to you, I'm going to ask it now, and that is, your documentary, okay, Home is a Hotel, is a slice of life of families of very varying needs and appearances and heritages and cultures and incomes. I mean, you cast a wide net here, and I want people to know, I find, my personal opinion is, the great strength of your work, Home is a Hotel, is that everybody who's never ever heard of an SRO can look at your work and see themselves in it. The old phrase, there but for the grace of God go I, because You prove that.
Well, thank you for saying that. I mean, so I guess, I don't know, maybe we should sort of define SRO for folks, which is, SRO stands for single room occupancy. And so that, and you'll see this in the film, but most of those residential hotels / they're also called SROs, the situation, right, is that folks have a room that's usually about 80 square feet, and then the bathroom and the kitchen are shared with everyone else on the floor, right? And so, like, our But I had mentioned before, but we made a short that was also called Home of the Hotel that was featuring just a woman and her daughter living in an SRO in Chinatown. And that was, you know, my dad is from San Francisco. He was born in San Francisco, Chinatown. I grew up in L.A., but I've been coming to the city all my life, and I've lived here since 2003. So, like, my primary point of reference for SROs was Chinatown because that's the neighborhood in San Francisco that has the highest number of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is historical, right? The waves and waves of immigrants from China needed a place, a cheap place to live when they first got here. A lot of them were migrant workers. They would work in fields part of the year and come and work in factories and other urban jobs another part of the year. So they were, you know, moving. They didn't need a place year-round. Back when it was very hard for Asian women to immigrate to the country because they were always accused of being prostitutes. It was mostly men that lived here, so they were like single men. What are they going to do? They're going to live in a room by themselves. But sort of like that was my reference point, and we made a film that was like very much about that, like new immigrant experience now.
Mm.
But in the process of making that film, we started to learn more about the shape that living like that takes for folks in other communities mm-hmm. in the city. So like the three neighborhoods that have a large concentration of SROs in San Francisco or Chinatown, and then the Mission District, which is predominantly Latino, and then the Tenderloin / South of Market area, which is kind of a mix of folks who, it's like a queer community, has like a large Southeast Asian community, and then has a large Black community, in addition to, you know, all of the diversity that is in San Francisco, but those kind of tend to be the profiles. And so, you know, each of those, both the background of everybody in those other neighborhoods is very different than the background of folks in Chinatown, and the experience is different. And so part of the intention from the outset of making a feature-length project, like why we wanted to make it, is we wanted to zoom out and honor that diversity of experience, right?
Mm-hmm.
And sort of like look at, you know, okay, like the concept of the short part was really sort of like, okay, San Francisco is crazy expensive. What is it like? What is the smallest like place you could possibly live? Right,
mm-hmm.
That's one room. That's an SRO. That's an interesting lens on the housing crisis here. And then sort of expanding that question, right? Like, what does it look like to live in the smallest possible space? Expanding that question to other communities because they're all bringing different things to that. So that, you know, that diversity of the, quote, cast of characters is in the film was intentional because,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's the San Francisco that I know and love,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's a very diverse, very much a city where all these different communities are constantly crossing paths on a daily basis.
And you know,
it has to be in the film.
And yes, and I knew it had to be, clearly, it was a choice to make that point. There's no question. But the point is far greater than even the director's choice, the wise director's choice to make it. The point is it's all true in 2023, and it's been true. Well, you answered several of my questions, and I'm glad. That's good. How did you go about casting it? Let me say this. I want to make a point, if I may. The diversity is not just racial or cultural. I saw people, well, of course, children, senior citizens, people who had jobs, people I don't know if they did have jobs, but artistic people, divorced people, abused women, immigrants, artists, musicians, and the blind woman. I mean, that's diversity too, and it's just...
Well, that's totally true too. And I think the thing, what I think comes through for folks in the film is that you know, how part of that diversity, we knew that diversity was there, but sort of the reason that diversity is there is because housing as an issue, right? Like housing touches everything. Like no matter what your issue that you care about is, or what demographic you're a part of, like housing touches your life. And so, what happens in the way that we currently sort of like do housing in this country is that whoever in our society is vulnerable is going to end up in a housing insecure situation like living in an SRO. Like, that's just the way that the system is set up to kick out. Like, whether that's by design or by accident, I don't know. But and so that's sort of like part of why that diversity is there. And I think that was really something else that we wanted to really touch on, is just like, I sort of compare the issue of housing to the issue of climate change, right? In the sense of like, it touches everything.
Mm.
And like, the solutions to it are, there's no like one solution, right? It's like, there are a lot of small solutions that all need to happen to do something about it. So yeah.
Yes, well, yes. And I'm fortunate because I've seen the film, but I think this is not an easy film to watch. And maybe you can't take it all in one piece, but you need to watch it. You need to be aware of it. You need to find out what's going on. And I know you said this, Kevin, you described the dimensions of an SRO, but I would like you to do that again slowly, because when you see this film and you see how families, not just individuals, but families are living, something has to be done. And I think that's what Kevin's film is saying. But you tell us, Kevin.
It's definitely tight. So, I mean, I think the best, probably the easiest point of reference for most folks is a dorm room.
Mm.
And so if you can imagine, you know, an 80 square foot dorm room, right? So you have probably a bunk bed on one side, and then maybe a refrigerator, maybe a bunch of shelves built into the wall on the other. And like, that's your whole home. Like, that's where you have to fit your entire life. And then your bathroom, your kitchen, you know, you're sharing those with 10, 12, 14 people, or not even necessarily people, 10, 12, 14 units. So those units might have 2-3 people in them, 4 people in them on the floor. And the building was probably built over 100 years ago, and, you know, the people that maintaining it, whether they're a private person or a nonprofit, are, you know, not resourced in a way that, like, enables them to really, like, be on top of upkeep. If you're in a one that's being run for profit, like, maybe they're intentionally trying to, you know, get people who've been there and there for a long time out because they can raise the rents and charge more for the room. So yeah, that's kind of the description of what an SRO is like.
That's their life. And also, of course, COVID didn't skip SROs.
No, not at all.
Talk to us about that.
And that was, I mean, like, that's one of the things about it. It touches the film. We don't sort of like dive super deep into it, but, you know, in San Francisco, the community that was hit the hardest by COVID was definitely the Latino community and the Mission. And a big part of that is because a lot of those folks are restaurant workers or like frontline service workers, and they live in SROs. And so you can imagine, even if you have a room to yourself, which a lot of them don't, how do you isolate when you have to share your bathroom and kitchen with, you know, 10, 15 other people? Like, it's impossible.
Mm.
And so, you know, especially in the early days, the Latino community in San Francisco was, like, one of the most heavily impacted communities because of that.
Tell us about, I know everyone's going to think of this because perhaps the most famous Section 8 we know from MASH, the film and the television series, but Section 8 is not a funny thing. Tell us, Section 8 housing assistance.
Yeah, totally. So, well, I don't know if I should give...
Don't give away, yeah.
But we'll just say that. So, one of the things that, one of the sort of policies that factors into the narrative of the film is this thing called Section 8, which is basically government-funded vouchers for, I forget the exact percentages, but it's something around like 60 to 75% of the cost of a rental unit. And so basically, if you are approved for a Section 8 voucher, you will get a voucher that you can give to a private landlord that says that the government will pay for, you know, like 2/3 or so of your rent, and you're responsible for the rest. And so obviously that is a program and that's based, and like the percentages are based on both the rent and like people's income. And so obviously that kind of program is super important for folks who are trying to get out of housing situations like SROs.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also a lot of prejudice against folks who are trying to rent housing with those kinds of vouchers. And so if you go on Craigslist, if you go on an apartment listing site and look through the listings, you'll see plenty of listings that say in all caps, no Section 8. Just like flat out, they won't even consider it. And like, you know, it's within their rights as like private landlords, but that doesn't help the situation of getting folks out of bad situations, whether that's out of a shelter, out of an SRO, out of some other situation that's like not good for them. And so I think one of the things we were hoping to achieve with the film is to combat some of that prejudice, right? And combat some of that prejudice, and then also I think, you know, see how truly transformative something like a Section 8 voucher, getting a Section 8 voucher can be. To see how truly transformative getting something like a Section 8 voucher can be to a family, and sort of like really change the trajectory of their lives. And hoping that sort of like folks seeing that will sort of encourage support for more funding for programs like that, and less prejudice against people who are utilizing this program.
One other thing I got from Home is a Hotel, your film that we're talking about now, is that in the United States, for every 3 households below the poverty line, less than 1 available affordable unit exists.
Yeah.
Is it your hope that your film, Home is a Hotel, will inspire, if not change in the system, then at least public awareness?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, so, this is always a tricky thing, but, like, you know, so San Francisco is, like, an extreme case, right? Like, housing in San Francisco Bay Area is, like, really insane. And a part of that is because the city didn't, or like the region, I shouldn't say the city, right? Because it's also, San Francisco bears, I think, a lot of the negative effects of the sort of like wealthier areas around it, the choices that those areas have made too, in terms of like their housing policy. But they haven't really, San Francisco Bay Area is like really underbuilt in terms of how much housing is created versus the size of the population and how it's been growing, right? Just like the economic hub here and how many people have been coming here for all the great things, the jobs, the diversity, the weather. It's a beautiful place to live. Like, I understand why people want to live here. But there's also this, and I think the city has sort of like bought into this to a large degree, this narrative that like, okay, we just got to build as much housing as possible. And like, we do need to build as much housing as possible, but I think it's important to notice where the mismatch in the need is versus what's being built. And so I think, you know, building what we're hoping folks sort of like understand is like building housing that's affordable to like working class folks really needs to be of primary importance, right? Yeah. Because you can't have a functioning city, a functioning society where, you know, people working full-time jobs and minimum wage can't afford a place to live. Like, that's not a functional society. And, like, unfortunately, that is the reality not just in San Francisco, but across the country. Like, I think a key telling point about the state of the housing situation in the country is when we started this film, when we were going around pitching it, we were citing this statistic that 0.1%, so 0.1% of counties in the United States, a person working full-time at minimum wage could afford a one-bedroom. Mm-hmm. So that was when we started working on the film. So when we were wrapping it up, we were going to put an end card in. So we were like, let's double-check that statistic. Mm-hmm. And so we found that by the time we had finished the film took about 5.5 years to make. By the time we finished the film in that 5 years, that 0.1% had gone to zero. So there's now no county in the United States where someone working full-time and minimum wage can afford a one-bedroom. Like, we're going in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a good direction to be going. And so I think that's just really, like, the key takeaway, I think, that we hope folks get from the film is, like, the old, like, understanding housing as a public good, right? Like, it helps us as a society, as a community, as a city, as a country, to have people being able to, like, afford a place to live.
Mm.
Like, I think that people can understand that, but that's not really, like, how things are set up in terms of, you know, the way that we handle housing policy in this country.
And you know, one of the things also your film makes clear is that while the rents, everyone's talking about the rising rent costs, and I've been a landlord, and I've had Section 8 people in my properties, and they were wonderful. But rents are increasing so much, but the federal minimum wage hasn't changed since 2009. How do we, when those two facts collide, what do you have to say to us?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, so, like, you know, I'm not a policy expert by any means. There are plenty of people who've spent entire careers studying this, and they can tell you a lot more about the many things that we need to, you know, sort of, like, reverse that mismatch in how much money people are able to earn and how much they have to pay for housing. But I will say that I think one of the key takeaways from my conversation with those folks is, like, this concept of decommodifying housing. And so thinking about housing, right, like, basically our housing policy in this country is set up for folks to think about housing as a financial asset,
mm.
right? And mm-hmm. capital is always going to maximize profit, right? So, you know, when housing isn't a place for people to live and housing is an investment, that's going to lead towards people making certain decisions and certain trends in that, right? And so if we flip that and we think about housing as a public good, right? Like, we think about water, right? Like, everybody understands the benefit to the community for water to be clean and safe to drink mm. and readily available to anyone, regardless of, like, how much money they make, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we sort of, like, reshape our thinking about how we treat housing to be more like water and less like, I don't know, the stock market,
mm-hmm.
that shifts the way that you act in so many ways. And so I think that's, for me, I think one of the biggest takeaways from my conversations with those folks is, like, prioritizing housing being affordable to everyone and understanding that that makes everyone's lives better, that makes the economy better, that makes communities better, that gives, like I said before, like, anything you care about, like, whether you care about immigration, whether you care about criminal justice reform, whether you care about climate, whether you care about being in disability, like, all of those things are made better when people can afford a decent place to live, and all of those things are made worse when people can't. And so really thinking about housing as, like, a fulcrum issue in terms of, like, changing these other things, or thinking about housing as, like, you know, it's a basic human need. Like, shelter mm. is a basic human need, and yet the way that we have various policies in our society set up, it doesn't really sort of, like, seem to acknowledge that.
Okay. It's a great analogy. All right, Kevin Duncan Wong, we need to know how to get a hold of you, your website, see your other work, social media. How do we support you?
Totally. Thanks. So the film is going to be playing at the Austin Film Festival coming up, and then we'll be at the San Diego Asian Film Festival on November 8th, and then we're going to be at New Filmmakers LA on November 18th. And if you go to our website, www.homeisahotel.com, you'll find links to all those screenings, as well as links to our Instagram and Facebook. You can find out about additional screenings that are coming up. And then we are, through one of our funders, we are supposed to offer the film to public broadcasting for a TV broadcast. So hopefully that will happen sometime in 2024. So if you follow us on social media or sign up for our newsletter, you'll hear about when that happens. And then we're also doing sort of a community screening tour with hopefully organizations across the country. So as those take shape, you'll hear about those if this one is coming to your town as well. So sign up for our newsletter, follow us on social media. That's all great. And then I'm personally on, I mostly do Instagram. I'm kind of like done with Twitter, but I'm on Instagram at Duncan Wong, DUNKINWONG, like the donut chain. If you want to follow my other work, I do have another documentary that's sort of like in early stages right now, so you'll probably hear about that soon.
Okay. Well, director-screenwriter Tevin Duncan Wong and his new documentary, Home is a Hotel. He's done a lot of work, a lot of good work, and you need to introduce yourselves to him online and in any way you can. Follow him, support him. This is good work and a necessary education, especially in a time when we're burning books. So, Kevin, thank you so much for being on the show. It was so informative, and I definitely appreciate your mission and the way you are carrying it out. Okay?
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. And it was great to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
You got it. And we'll come back sometime for sure and can catch us up. But best of luck on all the screenings that are coming up. And we did mention all the dates, right?
Yeah. Next, so if you're in Austin on the 29th and the 31st, we'll be screening at the Austin Film Festival. So, yeah.
Fantastic.
I think I missed the
rest of it.
Yes,
you did.
Those are all on our website, so yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much, Kevin. You take care. All the best, all right?
Thanks, you too.
Bye now.
And now, from WatchFireMusic.com, vocal artist Jenny Burton, singing Who Will Heal the World?
Who will heal the world?
Who will heal the world?
Who will stir the ashes? Who will bring the barren land to birth? Fallen man, mend the brokenhearted, build the families,
give back the dignity that's now been taken away.
Who will heal the world? Who will bridge the waters? Who will break the barriers between men? Now you know the
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. America, the field of dreams, occasionally. We are no longer what we thought we were. The good, bad, ugly truth is, it didn't begin with Donald Trump. However, like a Booth decapitation, Don the Con played cokeheads by bolstering the South Shall Rise Again, reawakening faux patriotism, whitewashing seething hate for our justice for all field of dreams. Increasingly, our age group, categorical culture, or political comfort zone is proliferating our weaknesses into a new all-inclusive enslavement, reverberating January 6, 2021. Whether right, left, or fence wobblers, we've allowed ourselves to be brought by lazy, repetitive corporate media, Wall Street warlord peddlers, and flag-waving, constitutionally illiterate conservatives into a collective, self-deceiving trifecta, which, if American democracy is to survive, we've got some serious, soul-searching scaffolds to strengthen sooner or lose any forward mobility away from the 21st century corporate boardroom occupants who've mangled our American dream potential into their bold Bill of Rights, violently clinging to the manipulated memories of the good old days of Southern poll taxes, Northern molasses to rum to slaves, to national book burning. MAGA Republicans have spawned a new nation, offering up domestic gun violence, invigorating the worst among our hypocrisy-ridden politicians, and a heartland turning evangelicalism heartless. First, they elected Tricky Dick twice, and then an administration of war criminals spinning our massive 9/11 tragedies into absolution of their complicity in the death and maiming of thousands of American and foreign lives while washing their hands in J.D. Rockefeller's black gold residue. Unscrupulously marketed, post-World War II Americans were brainwashed into believing we are superior to all life on Earth. Better than anyone, at anything, anywhere. We were not, and still aren't. Not even north of the Mason-Dixon line. Truly, it is okay not to be perfect, but it is perhaps the most sinful self-deception to think, and worse, proclaim ourselves morally superior to all. Current too-big-to-jail robber barons are Americans contributing for profit to our polluted water, food inequity, and nebulous air quality on an earth being devoured from the inside out. Whether negligently forgetting or simply anticipating a planetary relocation for those who pay, economic elitists are ignoring our human responsibility to be stewards, not rapists, of the earth. What exactly will MAGA Americans, shadowing Ohio's Pied Piper Jim Jordan, profit if he gains the whole world by forfeiting American souls? Yet, for some, truth struggles to reveal itself. And yes, historically, most of America's troubles have been caused by blindly following the lust for power of grumpy old Caucasian men. Nonetheless, not all old white men are anti-democracy and anti-humanity trumped. So discarding a stuttering kid who became president of the United States for a big liar's big lie is suicidal. The American experiment isn't so much failing as it is being failed. Parents with little education in education demanding teachers teach students what their parents were taught. Memorize dates, timetables, and half-truths until we too become dittos for leaders of institutionalized religion, hateful governors, and stockpiles of Wall Street's counting houses, financial institutions sliming the American dream. We have been programmed to look away from the true villains, oil company boards, and owners of private prisons, inciting homeland infighting over lies they tell us. Know this, in any attempt to disappear the power of a nation's electorate, the perpetrators' public faces disguise the devils who take from all deemed easily taken. Numbers like figures on a block, becoming figures on a ledger. The CEO to average worker pay ratio, 1965, was 20-1. 1989, it was 44-1. Today, 2023, 400-1. Enabling future generations to make better choices than we need replace book burning with character development through objective evaluation to prevent Supreme Coke puppeteers from keeping us in our place. Parroting mistakes were made. We spoke and understood as children in a Reagan fantasy where welfare queens were branded unworthy. Like children, we thought political profiteers Bob Menendez and Jared Kushner would not repeat Joe McCarthy and Spiro Agnew's deceits. But aging out of childhood, we must put away childish things, like a president who compromises our national security more even than Tommy Tuberville. We must master rational thought, adult civility, and the discernment to recognize the manipulation of patriotism by craven corporatism, filling our stomachs by sacrificing our international food sources, increasing denials from health insurers, and climate change blitz. Whether we believe in a little sand from the dust of Earth's surface, a touch of life-giving ocean salt water stirred by the unshakable, with something borrowed, a rib perhaps, in a garden paradise brimming with flowers, shrubs, and garnished with life and wisdom-bestowing trees, or whether we believe millions of years evolving from the sea through artistic caves to Grand Central Station. Either way, generations of powerfully ensconced money changers will continue to profit from our raging against each other, fighting their war against our freedom to think for ourselves and to dream. President Ulysses S. Grant said, "If we are to have another contest in the near future for our national existence, I predict that the dividing line will not be Mason and Dixon's, but between patriotism and intelligence on the one side, and superstition, ambition, and ignorance on the other." I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, and I know where my voice belongs. I hope the same for you. Thank you, and join us. Become one of the Reasonable Voices, heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.